Good evening. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, my name is Katie Zoglin. I am a trustee here at the World Affairs Council, and I'm your moderator tonight. It's now my distinct pleasure to welcome our two distinguished guests. Mike Abramowitz, on your far right, is director of the Center for the Prevention of Genocide at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. He leads the museum's efforts to make genocide prevention a national and international priority, and to educate the public and policymakers about the ongoing threat of genocide and related crimes against humanity. Before his 2009 appointment as director, Mike was the White House correspondent for the Washington Post. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and is a graduate of Harvard University. And to my immediate left is Rich Williamson, who is a non-resident senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution and a Buffett scholar and adjunct professor at Northwestern University. His work focuses on human rights, multilateral diplomacy, nuclear nonproliferation, and post-conflict reconstruction. Before these positions, Mr. Williamson served under President George W. Bush as presidential special envoy to Sudan and ambassador to the United Nations for special political affairs. Ladies and gentlemen, here to speak on the responsibility to protect, please welcome Mr. Abramowitz and Mr. Williamson. Tonight, I'll start off. I'm going to ask a few questions, and then, of course, you all have your cards to ask questions as well. So, Mike, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum stands as a testament to our commitment that genocide should never happen again, to fulfill that promise of never again. Can you give us a sense of how the Center for the Prevention of Genocide fits into the memorial function of the museum and how it guides the work you do around the world?
Sure. First of all, I want to thank the World Affairs Council for hosting us today, and I'm sorry my friend Jane Wales is not here, but thank you to Jane and her whole great staff for having us here. And I want to also say what a great privilege it is for me to be with my friend Rich Williamson, who we've worked closely for the last several years on a variety of issues, including the responsibility to protect, which we'll get into today. So as you pointed out, our museum is what we term a living memorial to the victims of the Holocaust, and we fulfill that memorial function in many different ways, including educational activities to educate school kids and professional audiences about the Holocaust. We lead the country every year in our annual Days of Remembrance. We have an amazing collection of Holocaust archives and artifacts that we are constantly trying to expand. But one of the most important ways that we fulfill our memorial function is to do what we can to try to prevent these terrible crimes from happening again in our time. And so we really feel a very urgent need and desire to try to warn our policymakers and the public about risks of genocide. We've been very aggressive on the issue of Sudan over the years, and we were one of the first to call what was happening in Sudan 10 years ago in Darfur to be a genocide. We've been very active in recent years in trying to really strengthen the U.S. Capacity to prevent genocide. The movie that this audience looked at featured the president at the museum, and he announced some very important steps, which we're still in the early phases of trying to really strengthen U.S. capacity, including the creation of an atrocities prevention board to mobilize U.S. Action in these areas. So we really want to do what we can to prevent these crimes from happening again.
Yeah. Thank you. Rich, when did you first become involved in working with the museum? And did memories from your work as the special envoy to the Sudan, how has that influenced your work with the museum? Why don't you start off with that?
Sure. First, I want to thank the people who were kind enough to give their time tonight with an interest in this. I think it's really tremendously important for people to be educated on this issue. I've had a chance to serve in ambassadorships now for three different presidents, and the public awareness on Darfur was instrumental in moving both the executive and legislative branch to be more proactive. And I first got deeply involved in Darfur when I was Ambassador to the Human Rights Commission in Geneva, and the president asked me to table what became the first resolution on Darfur anywhere in the world back in 2004. And then I saw this terrible tendency of these diplomats to be more interested in the multilateral diplomatic dance than the substance in those who died. And so that haunted me, and I'd gotten deeply involved in Darfur and then was asked to be the president's special envoy to Sudan, where Mike's predecessor, Jerry Fowler, had been head of Save Darfur and turned out to be a tremendous partner. And let me just take a minute to say that on this issue, the Holocaust Museum is a leader and does great work, and I felt tremendously honored to be able to work with them and my friend Madeleine Albright on this report. One thing that you learn, I've dealt with a lot of bad people, Robert Mugabe, Hun Sen in Cambodia, Omar al-Bashir. These bad things are caused by bad people that want to stay in power or get into power. None of these are caused by ancient ethnic hatreds. Sure, they're flare-ups from time to time. But there are some individuals who have made a conscious decision to open the gates of hell. And the results, since we pledged never again, are the Cambodian killing fields, where 2 million were killed, one-third of the population. Rwanda, 800,000 in 100 days, mostly by machetes. Bosnia, Kosovo, 2 million were killed in the North-South Sudan Civil War, up to 400,000 in Darfur, 2 million to 3 million in Eastern Congo. This is going on. What I appreciate, what Mike and the museum do, is try to engage people, and part of what they do is educational. I pull out a quote from a book by Father Drinan on human rights. Some of you will remember Father Drinan, who was in Congress for a long time, where he cited Solon, an ancient Athenian jurist, who said, "Justice will not come until those who are not hurt feel just as indignant as those that are." And it's the same with ethnic cleansing and genocide. The victims are mostly voiceless victims, and I've met with them in many places around the world. Every time I went to Sudan, I'd visit IDP camps and refugee camps.
And IDP?
Internally displaced people. And it's the same story. You meet with these women who are maybe 35 or 40, and they talk about how their village, there was fire from the sky one day. And then flatbed bed trucks ran through with 16 soldiers on the back with guns, shooting indiscriminately. They were followed by planes dropping 55-gallon drums of burning oil. And then the so-called devils on horseback, the Janjaweed, would come in, burn the crops, burn their straw huts, their homes, kill males from small babies to 80-year-olds, throw bodies into wells that had been used for generations so they'd decompose and poison the well, gang rape women as young as 6 years old, and when they were done, take a burning hot knife and brand them on the inside of their thighs so they could never escape the shame. Then these women would take what children were alive and go into the desert and walk for 3 or 4 days till they found an IDP camp. It's hard to believe today these horrors are going on, just like it's hard to believe chemical weapons were used against innocents in Syria. But it is a reality. And the hardest thing is not only seeing these children desperately holding on to life, but that these women have no hope anymore. And that's our responsibility. That's what never again means. And I think everyone in this room, those of us who have had the opportunity and privilege to serving in government or other positions in Washington, have an obligation to try to give voice to those voiceless victims, try to pressure policymakers, try to spread an awareness of what's going on, because silence is the greatest aid to Omar al-Bashir in Sudan, to Bashar al-Assad, who's now killed over 110 innocent people. And we should be outraged. We should raise our voice. And the Holocaust Museum helps people be aware of it. For that, I'm very thankful.
Thank you. Not too long ago when President Obama was speaking to the nation, he mentioned the concept of American exceptionalism. You know, that was in the context of Syria. But more broadly speaking, do you think that we as Americans, or you know, our American government, has a greater responsibility to protect, or greater responsibility than perhaps other countries? Why don't you try that one out first, if you don't mind, Mike?
Sure. Well, I believe the obligation to protect civilians is something that falls on all members of the human race. But I do believe there is a distinctly American role in this. And this is not to say that the United States is required to be the world's policeman and that every bad situation in the world requires an American response, or an especially military response. But I do think, we are, whether you like it, a global leader. And I think people do look to us. And I think it's in our DNA that we want to try to ameliorate wrongdoing when we suffering and wrongdoing when we see it. I think what's very interesting to me, before I came to the museum, I covered the White House at the Washington Post. And whatever one's criticisms of President Bush, whether you liked him or not, he cared very deeply, I thought, about the situation in Sudan. And he felt extremely guilty and extremely, I think he felt that was one of his major failures as president, not doing enough to address the genocide in Darfur. And I think the same thing with President Clinton, too, that when he was asked after he was in office what was his biggest regret, he would always say it was his failure to respond adequately to the genocide in Rwanda, which Rich talked about. So what's interesting to me is that presidents come into office and they don't really think that this issue of genocide, ethnic cleansing, war crimes is going to be with them, but it often, just because of the nature of our world, often crops up. And I think the reason they feel regret is because when America doesn't act, doesn't try to do what it can, inevitably the world, I think it takes away America's credibility and it takes away America's stature in the world. A little bit of us suffers when that happens. So I definitely do think that we have an American responsibility, but it's not a responsibility to do, it's an unbridled responsibility.
I'll come at it slightly differently. And some of you may not be comfortable with this first point, but I do think America's exceptional. We were the first country in the world founded on human rights, on inalienable rights. The Declaration of Independence didn't start with a litany of charges against King George. It started with all men are created equal with a right to. That makes us somewhat different. And one of the gifts of Woodrow Wilson, when we began to emerge because of our economy and our capabilities and our size as a world power, is he laid out the challenge that American idealism should animate our foreign policy. So I'd say we are different and have a different obligation because we owe it to our forefathers, our children, and the future to have some fidelity to those values. Second, and let me just note, there's a real tension there. Mike was kidding me for pulling out a couple quotes, but I do want to share them with you. Brent Scowcroft, the ultimate realist, once said, "Are we to stand by our principles? Yes, but we can't remake the whole world at once. We need to go step by step." Brzezinski, "You try to strike a balance between the use of power and promoting national security and interest to improve the human condition. You have to have a sense that what you are doing somehow in tune with the mysteries, unraveling of history, and pointing in the right direction." Kissinger once said, when he was asked about it, realism and idealism, you need both. You need realism to take the next step. You need idealism to know where you're going. You've got this tension. You've got this tension, but I believe our first obligation is national security, other vital interests, but we should be animated by our values. Doesn't mean you get in every fight, and that's one of the overhangs from the Bush administration. The United States has the largest foreign policy toolbox in the world. We can affect events in the world through diplomacy, through economics, through organizing others. It's only the last resort. So my disappointment, for example, with the Obama administration in Syria is not this latest Keystone Cops kerfuffle, but that 2.5 years ago we could have been providing assistance and helping the moderate rebels organize and have a bigger difference. So you always have that balance, but going to what Mike said as well, we have the only capacity today to deal with these. I remember when I was up in the Security Council doing the peacekeeping and stuff, and then Afghanistan happened, our European friends wanted to be involved, and Germany said, we'll do the training of police, which was great, but they had to rent planes from Ukraine to get their people to Afghanistan. The American people have no idea the little capacity of our friends and allies. No one can project power in the world except the United States. So we have that not because we want to run to every humanitarian issue, but we have the broadest interests. I think that also gives you a little more responsibility, even if it's just providing airlift. And Libya is a great example. The French and the British were going to take the lead. It was going to take 2 weeks. Oh, excuse me, it took 6 months. And they ran out of missiles in 4 weeks. Your tax dollars paid for the American missiles we gave the French and the British. We have a capacity, so we have more opportunity to address these issues. Also, we can be listened to. Also, we can organize folks. We can make a difference. So I think both on the value side, animating us, our history and keeping fidelity to where we've stood, and the world we'd like to see, and because of our capacity, we have greater responsibility and opportunity to make a difference.
You brought up the issue of the realism and the idealism. So in this ever complex world in which we find ourselves, how do you strike, decide whether it's whatever our self-interests are, the hardcore interests of the American government, however that is defined, versus humanitarian interests? How does one decide when one comes into play as opposed to the other, or is it not done that way?
Well, first of all, I agree with Rich that, you know, any president of the United States, their number one priority is going to be the national security of the United States and how to protect the homeland, how to keep the United States safe. However, what's striking as you study these issues is kind of the overlap, I think, between humanitarian interests and national security interests. I don't think there's a neat division between the two. You take a situation like Sudan, which has been over the last 30 years probably one of the top three humanitarian disasters in the world. You had a North-South civil war that took the lives of 2 million people. You had a genocide in Darfur, another several hundred thousand people died. You still have another 2 million people displaced, have not gone back to their homes in Darfur, and you have a government in Khartoum which is one of the most brutal, repressive governments in the world. Just in the past week, they've opened fire on their own citizens, killing several hundred people. So it's a great humanitarian calamity that's happened in Sudan. It's also no coincidence that Sudan was a place where Osama bin Laden first hung out before he went to Afghanistan. And to me, it says that those countries that are the countries that can incubate these kinds of humanitarian disasters are also a place that can, they're failed states. They can incubate terrorists. So I think there's actually an overlap. Not always. I mean, there's some places where really bad things happen that don't affect our interests. But I think in enough places, you take a place like Syria, you can't tell me that that's not both a humanitarian concern and also a national security concern for us. And I think one of the most interesting kind of trends, and the president said it in the clip that I believe that we showed earlier, that that preventing genocide is in the national interest of the United States. And I do believe that in my bones.
I think anyone who's had the opportunity to sit in the Situation Room with a president when they're trying to deal with these issues appreciates how incredibly difficult it is. And more variables than it would be for most people to fully get their arms around. And it only looks simple in a rose-colored rearview mirror of, oh, they should have done this, they should have done that. It's tough stuff. And I think we have to appreciate that.
Sorry about that. I don't know. I thought I had turned it off. Oh, you know what it is? It's my alarm. Sorry about that.
Make sure you're awake.
How late do you sleep?
I thought I set it for 7:30 a.m., but I set it for...
I thought the Holocaust Museum kept regular hours, but who knows?
Sorry about that, guys.
But I do think there's a bleed. And let's just talk briefly about Syria. There's a young boy, 13 years old, named Al-Khatib. The demonstrations have been going on less than a month. It had only been 2 months earlier that the demonstrations started in Tahrir Square, 3 months the demonstrations against Ben Ali in Tunisia. This boy went to a demonstration not in Damascus, but in a smaller town. He disappeared. 2 weeks later, his parents opened the door, and there was a rug, and they unrolled the rug, and under that was plastic, and they unrolled the plastic, and there was their son, mutilated, his penis cut off and stuck in his mouth, and his body decomposing. I think then we knew that Bashar al-Assad was not waiting for Ban Ki-moon to say, please be nice. This is not rocket science. To me, the question then is not whether you respond, but how you respond. And if we'd responded on the humanitarian basis, as I said, trying to work with the rebels, it would have been relatively cheap and easy. It may not have succeeded, but they would have had a chance. Instead, we sat on the sidelines, coming up with excuses for 18 months. And so there's a vacuum. Who came in? Extremists and al-Qaeda. This was knowable. Now we have 110,000 dead. We have 12 incidents of chemical weapons. The last one took 1,400. We have bleed that's destabilizing Turkey, who's a NATO ally of ours. There have been 3 incidents of shells across the border. If they go to war, we go to war. Under the NATO treaty. Jordan, our most reliable ally in the region, has 3.5 million people, and they now have 700,000 Syrian refugees. How's that working out for stability? Lebanon, which has been a basket case anyway, has 400,000 refugees. Iraq has 400,000, or 2 million refugees, half of them children under 12 years old. Destabilizing this region. Who are the winners? Iran, a rising Shia power whose ambitions are absolutely inconsistent with our interests, including nuclear, are the biggest winners right now. They're propping up Bashar al-Assad. They're putting money, and they're also helping strengthen Hezbollah through this. Hezbollah, that 10 years ago had 6 weeks of shelling into Israel. And Moscow, that was dealt out of the Middle East by Sadat in 1963 when he shifted from Moscow to Washington, and then the door was slammed in 1991, now is back in the Middle East. He's the conductor, and the U.S. is playing third fiddle. This is all because we refuse to deal with the humanitarian crisis. Now, look, I think it's a tough call about whether you took military action or not with the chemical weapons. What shouldn't have been a tough call is a year before that, when the president says it, you either get him to back off it if he doesn't mean it, or if he means it, develop contingencies. But what's going on in the Middle East is contributing to general turmoil. It's hurting our interests. It's hurting our friends. It's endangering Israel. And if we'd addressed the humanitarian crisis, at least there would have been a chance. But by sitting on the sidelines and doing nothing, all the costs are higher, all the problems are worse, the calamity is greater. I think it's a wonderful case study of why the question when you have these crises shouldn't be whether we act, but how we're going to react. And again, if you do it early, you've got a pretty big menu, far short from taking robust action, where the U.S. can bend events. We should have. We could have. And there'll be a lot more than 110,000 dead because we didn't.
And yet this is not the first time where the United States and other countries have sat by the sidelines during the case of mass atrocities. We have Rwanda, 800,000 were killed before there was an intervention. We have the Balkans. You know, there's many examples of that. Are there warning signs that we can learn from those cases? And then I guess the bigger question is, how does one get someone to act upon those warning signs?
So we have like 3 hours to talk about that. just narrow questions there.
Yes, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
You know, one thing I thought, by the way, that it might be just useful to say up front is that, and I think it's important coming from the Holocaust Museum saying this, you know, I'm not sure. We don't think that genocide is happening in Syria. We were talking about this beforehand. There are certainly war crimes, you know, which are violations of the laws of war. There's crimes against humanity. You know, the chemical weapons attack would be a great example of that. There could be even ethnic cleansing going on there, where they're trying to, you know, clear out certain ethnic or religious groups. So genocide is very particular crime, which is the intentional destruction of an ethnic, racial, religious group. It happened, obviously, the most famously in the Holocaust. It happened in Rwanda. It's a rare crime. So I just wanted to sort of put that on the table, because you and I had talked about that a little bit beforehand. I think, as Rich alluded to in his one of his answers, I think one thing that's been kind of interesting over the last 75 years as we've studied these different kind of cases, there has been an increasing recognition that genocide in particular, but these other crimes, don't just come out of nowhere. That if some of you might remember that during the time of the Rwandan genocide 20 years ago, there was a lot of reluctance, not just in our country, but in other countries, to get involved because it was perceived as Tutsis fighting Hutus, and it was just ethnic hatreds that we couldn't do anything about. But actually, when you drill deep into what was happening in Rwanda, you basically had a Hutu-dominated government that was quite radical and believed, wrongly, but believed that they were in mortal danger because of an invasion of the country by an army that was basically Tutsi, and they decided that the only way to deal with that was to kill every Tutsi in the country, and that launched the genocide. And what's interesting also when you look at Rwanda is that there are actual warning signs of what the Tutsi government was up to. They, for instance, one frequent warning sign, and you saw this, again, most famously in the Holocaust, but also most genocide cases involve dehumanizing language, hate speech. So there was a famous radio station in Rwanda called Radio Milcolin, which was broadcasting coded messages to the Hutus saying, basically, go kill Tutsis. So hate speech is an important sign. There is, you can see preparation being made. General Dallaire, who was the UN commander on the ground and is someone we're going to honor at the museum this year, on the 20th anniversary of the Rwanda genocide. He was one of the few people trying to blow the whistle on this, and he was warning the UN superiors that, by the way, I'm getting reports that there are weapons being amassed by militias, and I'm hearing that the militias are going to start attacking Tutsis. So, as Rich indicated, these are cases which there are warning signs, and we have to pay attention to those warning signs. It's not always easy. Sometimes the warning signs are mixed, but the thing, I think the core message that I'd like to leave your audience with is that these things don't come out of the blue, and you can watch it.
If I could just quickly, there are a lot of warning signs, and we've gotten smarter about that. The failure to act in Rwanda, the U.S. was the lead player. On direction from the White House, the U.N. ambassador called the head of peacekeeping across the street at the U.N., some guy named Kofi Annan at the time, to tell him if they came forward with a resolution to use force, we'd veto it. So none was ever went forward. I think the consequences of that inaction, however, animated Bill Clinton, pushed by Madeleine Albright, who had been seared by her own life experience and her own family's experience from Czechoslovakia, to take action in Bosnia and Kosovo that we wouldn't have done before. It's interesting. I think the Darfur case is fascinating, and I say that to you as people who really care about foreign affairs. One of the few groups that was really activated about the North-South civil war in Sudan was the evangelical community. In 2000, they started working the Episcopal churches in Tennessee and the Methodist churches in Texas, because whoever won, Al Gore, Episcopalian from Tennessee, or George Bush, a Methodist from Texas, there were going to be people in their community who would have been educated to help push. And I think that was part of the reason President Bush appointed my predecessor, Senator Jack Danforth, to be the first special envoy to Sudan. It's part of the reason he followed it, he pushed it, and we eventually ended up with a comprehensive peace agreement to end that slaughter. Unfortunately, the Darfur had begun separately. So citizens make a difference. Third, I'd like to praise President Obama, because he has made bureaucratic changes, including creating an atrocity prevention board, which is a vehicle to get the bureaucracy to respond and be accountable and look at these things earlier. It's dismissed by critics of humanitarian intervention and cynics, but having served in three administrations and positions in senior White House staff as well as diplomatic posts, bureaucratic structures matter. And President Obama took that step. Samantha Power, who's now the ambassador to the UN, was the first head of that. This is a positive thing. So there are things that can be identified. It is no question in my mind, a very small group of people ignite these events, open the gates of hell, and they can't do it just by saying, okay, today I'm gonna do it. They have to condition the population. They have to pre-position weapons. They have to have other means to spread the word. And these things can be picked up. And again, just like I said in the dramatic case of Syria, an earlier response can be less costly and effective, and that's what we need to do. And in this regard, what the museum's doing, what George Clooney and John Prendergast are doing in Sudan, what the Obama administration has done with atrocity prevention board are steps in that direction.
And along that line, our politicians often take cues from the public, you know, whether or not to act and whether or not to intervene abroad. So what, you know, what can be done to help change or shape the political will, for example, if there are mass atrocities taking place abroad? Is there a way? Should there be a way?
Well, we're talking to a guy here who's thought about the influence between politics and foreign policy for 30 years. I'd be interested in what Rich has to say. But, you know, from my perspective, working at the Holocaust Museum, you know, what's interesting when you look at history over the last 75 years, and I spent a lot of time this summer actually reading some books about the 1930s, about Ambassador William Dodd and about Raphael Lemkin, who was the creator of the Genocide Convention. You know, and what's interesting, you know, even during the Holocaust, or in the years up to the Holocaust, the American public was very, very opposed to getting involved in the European conflict. Really, up until the eve of the war, of World War II, the American public was deeply skeptical of intervening, and Roosevelt kind of had to drag America into that war. And so I think that you know the skepticism towards Syria today does not surprise me, especially after a feeling of overreach over the last 10 years. So I think it's the job of presidents, first of all. It's also the job of civil society groups. It's a job of educational institutions like the Holocaust Museum to really educate people about these issues and to really shape public opinion. I mean, the presidents do take their cues from the public. And I think one reason that President Bush got to be more active around the issue of Darfur is because there was a demand signal being sent to him from students on college campuses, from the evangelical community, from the Jewish community. And so I think that when you see that demand signal come from the public, that's when politicians are more likely to act.
Would you like to add?
I think there's two dimensions. One, it does matter when people are informed and active. When I became the President's Special Envoy to Sudan, I had to change my email 3 times because I think I got a million emails in the first 48 hours from these student organizations and others. It does have an impact. But two, and this Mike talked about it, Washington said don't get involved in foreign entanglements. Jefferson, Madison, there's a series of quotes about the lack of wisdom, began to change in the 20th century because of our size and our interests. And so Wilson, who had run of I've kept you out of war, flipped over and led getting us into war the next year. I think the 30s are very instructive. There are 3 books that came out this summer about basically 38, 39, 40, 41. And they have different little gems inside of them. But Charles Lindbergh spoke before 45,000 people at Soldier Field in Chicago to say we have to get ready to deal with Berlin and that we'd be able to do business with them and we shouldn't risk anything. That was the sentiment. We had tough economic times, tougher than today. But presidential leadership, I would argue, from Teddy Roosevelt, when there was no public support for being involved, won the first Nobel Peace Prize by negotiating the end of the Russian-Japanese War, and he built the Panama Canal. Wilson ended a war where hundreds of thousands died from gas. In the late 30s, Franklin Delano Roosevelt began, against overwhelming opposition, to help the British sustain themselves and to begin our industrial capacity for when we went to war. It took presidential leadership. So I think part of it's an informed public, efforts like the Holocaust Museum, like the World Affairs Council. But it also, in the end, requires presidential leadership. I was around, because I'm older than dirt, when after Vietnam it was, we don't want to do anything. We want to retreat. Nobody back then would have said there would be an end of communism. But presidential leadership changed that. We have lots of reasons to worry about ourselves economically, social issues, challenges, huge fatigue because of the overreach and bad management of Iraq and Afghanistan. But you don't have the luxury. So in the end, it's presidential leadership. And only the public can hold the president accountable whether or not they do or don't. Again, these are really hard decisions. If you sat in the Situation Room with presidents, you have great sympathy for what they have to decide. I'm not saying they're easy. But the challenges are there. The world's not going to go away. Bad people are going to still do bad things. And finally, at the very least, when bad guys do bad things, you should say, you SOB, you're doing bad things. Robert Mugabe wasn't surprised when I said that to him. Omar al-Bashir wasn't. Hun Sen, they know they're doing bad things. It doesn't surprise when you say it. What they're surprised is when the world's greatest power, with a certain moral underpinning, doesn't say it. It's a license for them to continue to do bad things, whether it's in China, whether it's in northern Myanmar, whether it's in Sudan. So even if you don't have the guts or the wherewithal or the support to take more action, at least we should be honest and call to account those who are doing terrible things. And many administrations of both political parties get pretty bad grades for that. But we could at least and should be doing that.
A couple members of our audience have asked, you know, well, we're talking about America's responsibility. What about the responsibility of other members of the international community, of Europe and other great powers? How do they play into this equation, and how do you motivate them to act?
Let me just say, I have the distinction and embarrassment of having more Senate-endorsed jobs related to the UN than any other American in history. Assistant Secretary, 3 different ambassadorships.
Nobody tried to block you?
I'm sure they wanted to, but they were had better things to do that day. I will tell you, nothing gets done at the UN Security Council if the U.S. doesn't lead. And if you're not willing to do it, it ain't going to happen. Period. End stop. Secondly, if one of the 5 members have a deep vested interest, it ain't going to happen. Which was why I have at times called various administrations and said, oh, we're going to deal with this by going to the UN. That's a posture, not a policy. It's to say I'm doing something, I'm not doing anything. It's basically I don't want to do anything, it's too costly, so I'm going to go to the UN. You will never get a resolution out of the UN that cripples Bashar al-Assad until he's gone. It's not in Russia's interest. It's not going to happen. You know, Churchill once said that legislation you shouldn't be watching made, it's like watching a sausage factory. The UN Security Council is a sausage factory. Furthermore, a couple times I'd say in the UN Security Council, and they'd all talk, well, we have to do this, we have to do that, I'd raise my hand and say, you know, when you're saying we, you're talking about me, and we're not going to do it. So they all know it. It's all posture. Now, having said that, France is willing to get active in Francophile countries and can make a difference, as they did in Mali, as they did in Cote d'Ivoire. But only for a short time, and then you've got to rally the international community, which the U.S. has to do. In Kenya, that was a very small dispute. There was some ethnic cleansing going on. A special envoy from Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was sent. It was Kofi Annan, and it succeeded to broker a deal. But in the end, it's a lot better to have people with you than against you. You can get support, as we did in the first Gulf War, which basically was paid for by others. But we shouldn't pretend there's an international community that's going to enforce these things, which is why it's important to always work with all the other countries, because all of them can make a contribution that matters. So even when you're going nuts in deliberations, you got to give them respect, you've got to listen to them, because in the end, you want them to help you. U.S. is not always so good at that. We should be better.
Well, I would just add a couple of points. First of all, we haven't really talked during this session about the responsibility to protect, which was the subject of the movie that opened this. And it's the responsibility to protect of the entire international community, not just the United States. So while we can maybe agree that the United States has a special role to play, an important leadership role, actually, every country in the world, including some miscreants, I think, like Sudan and Syria and others, have, you know, basically said that they agree that they all will protect their civilians from four crimes: genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. And so it's really a global responsibility. It's a shared responsibility. And I actually think that if you, while Rich is the expert on the UN Security Council, I think if you look at some of these cases around the world, you see that the most effective action is taken when it's a multilateral action. And oftentimes, the failures are multilateral. Well, I'm thinking of a couple of cases, you know, Kosovo, when NATO, many other countries acted together to basically prevent what many believed would be ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. In Libya, I think, you know, there's that situation has gone south in recent months. But I think one reason why we were able to get a strong action there when Gaddafi was threatening Benghazi was because the Arab world basically supported what France, Britain, and the United States wanted to do. I think it's also interesting to look at some of the great genocides in the last 75 years, and I'm thinking of two in particular. One is Cambodia, where Rich alluded to. 2 million people died between 75 and 79 at the hands of the Khmer Rouge. And then Rwanda, 800,000 dead within 3 months. In both these cases, the United States did not end the genocides. In Cambodia, it was ended by the Vietnamese army. In Rwanda, it was ended by the RPF. So I do think we need to be a little bit humble about our role in this, that it's a global responsibility, and that I do think that we need to be alert to this, but oftentimes it's other countries that are critical to dealing with this problem.
Let me just one real brief intervention. I believe one of the UN's great contributions is norm setting. I teach a course on U.S. foreign policy and human rights. It really matters, even when bad guys sign it with no intention of doing it. If you talk to refuseniks from Russia, dissidents in Chile, et cetera, around the world, they take succor and strength from America speaking out, but also that their own government signed things they weren't living up to. And it was a way to organize and rally against it. So I do think the UN plays a really big role. Second, as I noted, I do think the more you can work with others, the better. And third, I think Mike's absolutely correct. You will find regional organizations or regional powers that have a stronger vested interest that will get involved and make a difference. ECOWAS in Cote d'Ivoire, et cetera. So I align myself with those observations of Mike.
A couple people in the audience were interested in your thoughts on how both media can help rally people at the civil society level to mobilize them when there is a genocide or mass atrocities. What, you know, words do you have? Can that be used to bring together different voices that aren't typically heard? Do you see any changes happening at this point with new media?
Well, if I could just, as someone who was in the media for 25 years and have watched the changes that have taken place in the global media industry, it's clear to me that one of the casualties of the changes is foreign coverage. And these issues that we're talking about are basically not being covered right now by the media. By the U.S. media. In Sudan, I would venture to say there's been I don't think a reporter has gotten into Darfur from a Western country in the last 3 or 4 years. I could be wrong, off by one or two, but basically it's uncovered. Now, part of this has to do the bad guys, like the people who run Sudan or the people who used to run Burma. They are very restrictive, and they keep the media out of these places. And they've found that if they keep the media out of these places, that it can be effective in shutting down coverage of it. So I think the changes in media have been damaging in one respect. But I do think that the new media that you're talking about, the rise of satellite technologies that allows you to survey situations, above the earth, the rise of social media channels have really also kind of made it possible to detect some of these things perhaps beforehand. I'm struck, for instance, and I think Rich is on a very important and interesting group called the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, right? Okay. And so I think so in North Korea today, there are these gulags, essentially, that are basically slave labor camps, where it's an estimated 200,000 North Koreans live there. We now are starting to get some knowledge of what's happening in these camps because of survivors. This is uncovered by the media. But however, there's global satellite imagery that has detected these camps. We know they exist because they've been detected by this global by satellite imagery. So I think the picture of the media is kind of a mixed picture. There are some very negative developments towards spotlighting these kind of egregious human rights violations, and there's sort of promise for the future.
And how about just bringing it back home a little bit in terms of you said that frequently the politicians aren't going to act, essentially, unless there's a big demand from the grassroots level. Have you seen any efforts where media is used to bring together different sectors of civil society here at home to pressure our legislators to act?
I think Darfur is a great example. And I tried to think why it broke through all the clutter. I think there were two things that mattered. One, Hotel Rwanda. And for most people, and I've been at places where it was like that, the thought of a car driving and all kinds of bumps and, oh my God, those are bodies, was chilling. And then the new media. It was a way to organize students, a way to organize diffuse people all over the country. I think it was a great example of how the new ways to communicate can break through. And I think those opportunities should hopefully be enriched and deepened, and hopefully there'll be a little more space for foreign affairs, whether it's the mainline media or the other alternatives. The good news is my kids, they travel all over the world. I think there's a lot more Americans that find that is just something commonly able to do. And so they're more sensitive, and they know more foreign students and other things. So there's the opportunity to galvanize, which I think is even greater than it was in the past. So it's a mixed blessing. I agree with Mike. There's the discouraging thing is the Washington Post, New York Times, Chicago Tribune, LA Times have just a couple foreign bureaus where they used to have 24 or 30.
And what efforts is the museum doing to help educate, students, whether at the high school level, university level, about genocide prevention, about the responsibility to protect? Are you all able to do some of that outreach?
We do. We do it in a lot of different ways. We work very closely with high school social studies and history teachers to arm them with information, reliable information about the Holocaust in particular, but also current day genocides. And you know, we have teacher forums all over the country in which we try to influence the education in American high schools. We have a very active campus education program. I think that in the long term, the museum's greatest influence could potentially be on our website. And just to give you some sense of the numbers here, we have about 1.7 or 1.8 million visitors a year who come to the museum in person. And that is that actually makes us one of the most heavily visited tourist destinations among museums in Washington. There are a couple of museums that get more tourists than we do, but we're up there. But increasingly, many of our visitors are coming to us online digitally. We now translate our Holocaust encyclopedia into 15 different languages. So Farsi, Urdu, Arabic. And so we are exposing parts of the world that are, some of which are still in denial about the Holocaust, to authoritative information. So I think our digital engagement over the long term will be our greatest form, because you know, not everyone's going to be able to come to Washington to see our great exhibits. They're going to hopefully come to our website.
We have several questions about on the concept that when these massive human rights abuses occur, whether it's genocide, whether it's war crimes, and so on, is there sort of a threshold? I mean, bad things happen all over the world all the time, but what is the threshold level that might trigger, be appropriate to trigger some kind of response? What are the impediments to responses? I'm just asking several questions together because we're close to our end. In the response, why is there much more of a focus on military intervention as opposed to prevention, as opposed to peacekeeping? So those are very large subjects, but if you could address some of those.
A couple quick observations. Yeah. One, actually the efforts to prevent these type of atrocities are going on. Unfortunately, the only time most Americans realize it's a discussion is when it gets to that point where military action's taken or talked about. As I said earlier, we have this huge foreign policy toolbox, from just calling out bad guys to working with their neighbors, working with our allies, diplomatic isolation, putting some financial economic stress, as we're seeing with Iran, it has an impact, et cetera. And these things are going on. But given the small amount of oxygen that's given to foreign affairs, they're things that are not noted very much. We look at the sensational cases, the terrible ones. Not many people know about what happened in Kenya to stop the ethnic cleansing, or in Cote d'Ivoire when Gbagbo wouldn't accept the results of an election and there was some ethnic killing, et cetera. There are things that are going on that we should take encouragement from. And there are things the U.S. may have to provide unique logistical support, but we're not sending any men to Mali. We would like the French, before they announce they're going to do it, to call us, as opposed to the next day when they say, oh, by the way, you've got to get our troops there. But the fact is there are others willing to do it and should be doing it. The responsibility to protect is important because it is a general acknowledgement and norm. I like to think of it as like in Africa, how do you get a path? The elephant walks through it, and after walking through it enough times, the grass, there's a beaten path. That's what this norm about addressing atrocity crimes is about. And it's not only the events on the ground, whether it's Kenya or Cote d'Ivoire or Sudan, Libya, but it is the day-to-day work of some great institutions like the Holocaust Museum that are committed to educate people, to let them be aware of it. And let me just say personally, when my kids were in middle school and they went to visit, we took them to concentration camps. That is a searing a searing event that they never forget. Now, not everyone's fortunate enough to experience that firsthand. But what the Holocaust Museum is the next best thing, by allowing testimonials to be available, let people learn about what happened. And to me, that's very important if we're going to beat down the grass and have a path where we're going to walk successfully to start to curb atrocity crimes.
Well, thank you for those nice words about the museum, Rich. You know, the one thing I would just say, because I know we're running out of time, but I totally agree with the sentiment in the crowd that, you know, there's more, it's more than just military action that we're talking about. One of the real challenges, I mean, the media will focus properly on those cases which are so far gone, you know, like in Syria, other places where really military options are being debated. But there's so many other cases which don't reach that point. And really your goal is to prevent these situations from metastasizing into places where you have to consider military action. That's really a failure. And I think that one thing that I think is frustrating, I mean, when you're in the job that I have and you think about this all the time, it's obviously can be a very pessimistic, dark world. And I mean, there's a lot of failure to go around, a lot of blame to go around, and it's not always pretty. But I do think, I try to be a glass half full kind of person, and if you look at the last 20 years, there are cases where early warning, really paying attention, early diplomatic action have avoided the worst. And I would just like to say, while Sudan has been a litany of failures over the last 30 years, there was a referendum in 2011 in South Sudan, which many people were predicting a year out was going to be bloody. There would be tens of thousands of people killed. And what you really saw is Sudan's neighbors, you saw the European community, you saw the United States really focus on diplomacy, on development assistance to southern Sudan, which remains one of the poorest areas of the world, and the worst was averted. Now, no one's going to, you know, hand out cookies for the great work that they did in southern Sudan, but I do believe that it was a success story. And so I think you just need to weigh that not everything is always a failure, although sometimes it may seem that way.
Well, thank you both. Unfortunately, time has run out, and I wish we could go on much longer, but I just want to thank you both on behalf of the World Affairs Council and the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. I'd like to ask you all to join me in thanking our guests for their interesting remarks.